This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers.
Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week we are joined by Amber Phillips. Amber and I have talked for a number of years. I find her to be an indispensable resource. She explains and analyzes politics for the Washington Post. And as many of you already know, she authors the 5-Minute Fix newsletter. This is a quick analysis of the day's biggest political news. This is no easy feat to try and distill all this really difficult and complicated political news into an understandable newsletter for all of us, and she always does it. She joined the Washington Post in 2015 and was previously the one-woman DC bureau for the Las Vegas Sun. She's originally from Texas and has reported from as far away as Taiwan. The Fix was an official honoree for the best political blog in the 2017 Webby Awards. I always love talking to Amber. I think this is her third time back on the podcast, and she always gives me something new to think about, even when I think I know a lot about these topics. We talked about the Trump administration. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Amber, thank you so much for joining us again. You are one of the few repeat guests, and it's because you always bring such great information. And I'd love to dive right in and talk about something that I saw on one of your very helpful Instagram reels, which is takeaways from Trump's speech to the joint session of Congress. So could we start there with what did you know? What do you think we need to know about that address?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, Jessica. I learned so much talking to you from my newsletter that I do at the Washington Post, so I'm thrilled to be on your show. And I thought his address was a really big moment for the president because it came, you know, 6 weeks in after this, like, attempts at massive upheaval, both domestically and foreign, and he was going to go justify that to a Congress that he's really basically ignored. He hasn't tried to do much of anything with them. And it wasn't a hard job on the Republican side because that is just what it means to be a Republican these days, is to fully support everything Trump does. And, you know, Trump even commented in a speech, Democrats were never going to support him. He's right about that. But what struck me was how partisan the speech was and how much he is very much diving headfirst into these, keeps saying, like, massive attempts to change federal government as we know it and shift the entire country rightward. Like, he spent a lot of time talking about executive orders that doubled down on the cultural wars that the right really enjoys, and a lot less time talking about the price of things that you would think a president with lowering approval ratings might want to talk about, because that is why he got elected.
Well, and it did strike me that it felt more like a campaign speech or a pep rally than it did like a typical, I know it wasn't officially a State of the Union, but these are always styled as essentially a State of the Union address. Is this, you think, just what we are going to see for the next 4 years, which is speeches that you would think might be more about legislative proposals or economic issues are more focused on more of a campaign rally theme? Again, that was my takeaway.
Yeah. Yes, that's my takeaway, too. And I think I would venture to say yes. Like I said at the top, the president has shown little to no interest in working with Congress, despite having Republican majorities, very slim ones, but in both chambers. They got the best outcome they could have hoped for in this election. And he's just not doing much with them.
Well, could we talk a little bit about this? Because you are such a keen observer of what is going on in Washington, and you help me always think through some of the bigger questions that I have. Why do you think that we have seen so many executive orders when Republicans do control all of the political bucket, so to speak. Republicans have the White House and Congress and Senate. And obviously, as you said, it is by the thinnest of margins, but there is Republican control. And at the same token, much of what Trump wants to accomplish is being done by executive action. And that, as you and I have talked about offline, kind of creates different legal questions. It's just harder to accomplish some things without talking to Congress first. So why do you think we see that preference for executive orders?
Yeah, my take on this is that, and he and his allies have, I would say, alluded to this, is that it's harder to legislate. And even though you pass executive orders and they might get rolled back by the courts, as many of them are starting to, or at least paused, it's much easier to sell those as action to the American people. I like to contrast like the first, you know, 6 or so weeks of President Trump's second term with President Biden, where he dove right in with Congress. He made a big deal that he was going to try bipartisan legislation. I think at this point they had a stimulus bill passed. Democrats were working on something that didn't come to fruition, a couple different things, judicial reform, voting reform, police reform. Then he got bipartisan stuff passed through Congress, like the CHIPS Act to boost semiconductor manufacturing with Democrats and infrastructure law, climate change. I mean, he did a lot with Congress. And you know what we heard voters say during the campaign? They weren't really sure what the president had done to improve their lives. I think if you go anywhere on the street, you can ask someone whether they like Trump or not, they can name something he's done. But more accurately, right, the problem with this is tried to do through executive orders. And you're the one who tells me this, and I say it all the time, Jessica, is like, government's a shipping container, right? It's so slow. And you can't just turn it with signing of a pen, like he's really pretending to do.
That does sound like something that I would say. But yes, that's so interesting in the sense that President Biden, who, of course, was a longtime member of the Senate, either, you know, by virtue of experience or by virtue of just completely different strategies when it comes to what it means to be the chief executive, went straight to Congress. And that, of course, is harder and implemented a number of big legislative changes. And it does seem to me a failing of the Biden administration that people aren't able to point to something that happened or changed. Whereas with respect to the Trump administration, some of these actions may be overturned, but I think people can tick off a few big, bold changes that President Trump has tried to implement here. Let's talk about those changes. I know you've written about this, and I think DOGE is maybe the thing that feels the most opaque to people. And I know you've written about its legality and
also what they're trying to do. Like, what are they doing?
Well,
that's something that I had a question on.
So can you help us out with that in the sense of what is the Department of Governmental Efficiency? Is it truly a department? Does Elon Musk truly head it? Because we see in the joint address, Trump said Elon Musk is the head. In court filings, there's an indication that Elon Musk isn't the head. We're not sure if Elon Musk's recommendations are suggestions or if they're viewed as mandates. Can you help us first just kind of make heads or tails of what is this thing that we keep talking about?
Exactly. What is it? Such a good question. Such a smart question. So it didn't come out of a vacuum. It's actually a derivative of an organization, as my colleagues have reported, set up by President Barack Obama to consult on federal technology stuff. That's how I described it. It's like very, very, very technocratic and bureaucratic, right? This is what Musk and his team has seized on and co-opted for reasons that I don't think we fully understand, to slash government funding. So they kind of said, oh, this is ours now. And nearly 24 engineers and other existing technical staff resigned last month in protest, accusing Musk's team of, quote, pulling this up, mishandling sensitive data and breaking critical systems, saying they don't want to be a part of it. So that's like what we're talking about, where this came from. Then Musk took over and just boom, 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 like moved so fast, his critics saying purposefully, to confuse his opponents and to stun the opposition. And what they have tried to do, I've broken it down to a couple different sections, which is, number one, dramatically trim the U.S. budget by cutting its workforce. I think that's the one thing everyone will say, oh, yeah, yeah, okay, I think that's what DOGE is trying to do. And an AI researcher at Bentley University in Massachusetts told me he's coming to this from the perspective of just slash as much budget as possible, replace as many workers with AI as possible. Like, that is just what a tech guy dropped in Washington with unlimited support and money thinks should be done, essentially. How he's doing that is getting access to and control of sensitive government data, like the most sensitive. I'm not aware of him getting a hold of nuclear codes or anything like that, but like Social Security payments, the government's entire payment system through the Treasury Department to pay bills for anything, for anyone, period. My colleagues reported today, or this week, excuse me, child support data, IRS tax information. It's like Social Security numbers. It's just any kind of personal information the government might have about us. Musk and his team possibly very likely have, at least in read-only format. Why? Why? It's difficult to discern what the immediate endgame is, one expert told me. And then to what end all this is happening, like why you get the data, why you're trying to cover the workforce, is a major unanswered question. Obviously, something looming over this is his massive conflicts of interest by having billions and billions of contracts with the federal government for all his companies.
Right. And can you help us kind of contextualize the part that you so accurately said, I think is what people know, right? Which is help the federal budget by cutting the workforce. Now, my immediate question is typically like, well, is that money that's being spent that we needed to spend, or is that truly fat, so to speak? And I know the president ticked off in that joint session some numbers with respect to the money we're saving. And I know that fact checkers have contradicted some of that information. And I'm not going to go line by line at this point. But do you have a sense, like, where are we in what percentage of the workforce? I know that we're recording this episode on March 7th. Have the numbers when it comes to unemployment reporting been reflected yet? Because it seems to me that the more people you fire, the more obviously the unemployment numbers will be impacted. And we know that that has a significant impact on the economy. So it's a very, very broad question, Amber. It's totally not fair, which is like, where are we on this?
Right. The federal government has laid off 10,000 jobs. It's a lot of people. It is economists and local officials tell me it's reverberating, throughout the country. Like, I talked to an economist in South Dakota the other day who was like, yep, we're feeling it. But the economy, the government just reported today, added 151,000 jobs in February in spite of all that. So we don't really know where this is going. And it seems like Musk and President Trump are intent on cutting more jobs. But I think the big picture takeaway I want to share are the facts, which is that you can cut federal government workers to bare bones. You can also try to get rid of all suspected fraud, and certainly there's fraud in the government, and it wouldn't make much of a dent in the federal budget deficit. That's how much we spend every year. How much we overspend, essentially, and the government isn't taking in for taxes or tariffs or other forms of income. So it's just what experts tell me is they're looking in the wrong haystack. And that's why I think it's really interesting to turn from the White House over to Congress. And there, Republicans are doing one thing for Trump, probably Republican strategists tell me might be the only thing they get done for him before the midterm elections, which is to pass big tax cuts, extend President Trump's tax cuts, and maybe expand more of them. And there, they do want to pay for it because you have Elon Musk and Trump saying, we need to cut spending, federal spending. So they want to pay for these tax cuts because if you're going to lose revenue on the budget, you know, you need to balance the books another way. And 86% of the federal budget does not come from the federal workforce. It comes from entitlements and defense combined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hardest things to cut.
So 86% does not come from the workforce. This may be an unfair question, but I feel like you're explaining something that's so important in terms of just trying to figure out how big these buckets are. Like, how much money are we saving by cutting the federal workforce versus how much money will not come in as a result of the taxes? And so when we think about the tax cuts, and I know this is forward thinking, we don't know exactly what those tax cuts would look like. Do we have just a very broad sense of how much revenue would be lost versus the percentage of spending that we have saved? Meaning, you know, just a basic kind of balance sheet here. Where are we?
Yes, that's a great question. I don't know exactly where we are in terms of when you add in all this federal government layoffs, because the number I'm about to give you comes from the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And they're just like, their main goal is just balance the books. Like, that's what we need to do. And so they ran Trump's proposals during the campaign, which included, he was very clear, I want to extend my tax cuts and I want to not tax tips, for example. He brought that up in the State of the Union, and I want to cut fraud, you know. And the committee didn't know at the time whether that was going to result in 10,000 federal government layoffs in a matter of weeks. But what they did say is Trump's plans would add trillions to the deficit. That's a big number. That's a big number that can only be done by cutting Medicaid. The Nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office actually said today. Or, you know, Medicare or Social Security, which those two, because they mostly deal with older Americans, aren't going to be touched. Medicaid is health programs for low-income Americans, and that's what Republicans have zeroed in on. It doesn't have quite as strong as a constituency. So, like, more money will be spent than earned.
Are entitlements on the table? So my understanding on a very broad level, which you're confirming, is that entitlements are the vast, vast percentage of the federal budget, entitlements and defense. And this is budget season. There may be a government shutdown in a week from when we are recording this episode. And I'd love your comments on that as well, or your thoughts on that as well. But I think one big question people have is whether or not these entitlements are on the table. You said Republicans are kind of zeroing in on Medicaid. Is this something where everything is a possibility that, you know, it's Social Security may be cut, Medicare may be cut, or are we really looking at Medicaid?
It is so hard to answer that question because before my colleagues reporting about Social Security, which I'll get to in a minute, I would have said, oh, Medicaid, like for reasons I just explained, there's not as strong of a constituency for that program. Now, there actually, Republicans are starting to realize, is a stronger constituency than they realize. And that is that a lot of people in states that voted for Trump on Medicaid, one Republican who works to get Republicans reelected in the House told me Speaker Mike Johnson has the fourth most Medicaid recipients in his district of all of Congress. So she said he's not going to do anything that hurts himself at home. But what they will try to do is waste and fraud in Medicaid. Again, that's not without like broad restructuring. And experts say, hey, we should restructure these entitlement programs. They could run out of money and some benefits have to be cut in like a decade or so. But without that, without the political will or strength to do that, you're not going to get balance the budget sheets for Trump's tax cuts, and then it's going to be very difficult to restructure these programs just on, quote, waste and fraud alone. Then the reason I want to say, well, now anything goes, is because there's like a Trump-appointed guy managing Social Security Administration until the Senate approves his other guy. And this Trump-appointed guy, my colleagues reported, said privately that these DOGE officials are going to be cutting Social Security, the administration itself, and they'll make, quote, mistakes, which obviously is upsetting to anyone who loves the program. And there's 73 million Americans who rely on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just not clear how the Trump administration feels about entitlements. The president on the campaign trail said, I'm not cutting any of it. Republicans say, well, we need to cut it to save money. And then, you know, you got the leader of the House saying, but a lot of my constituents are on it. And then you have people within Social Security saying, well, cuts might happen to our program.
So that is a very educated and complete answer to we're not sure, which I think is something we might be saying, we don't know. Yeah, which is very fair. But you helped us think through why we're not sure and what the moving parts are. And since we're talking about budget season, and only because it's like always an embarrassment of riches when we talk, because we can talk about anything, I do get the question a lot from people about where I think we're going with respect to whether or not there'll be a shutdown, a compromise. Could you kind of remind us what the options are, in the sense that we have continuing resolutions, which is essentially kicking the can down the road? I think people aren't entirely sure what we mean when we say the budget process and a potential shutdown.
I know. Honestly, y'all, I gotta remind myself every time, because it's confusing and Congress doesn't make it any easier when they don't do their job. So their basic job is to fund the federal government. They're supposed to do that every fall. October 1st is when the new fiscal year starts. And they're supposed to do that by passing bills through committees, one that deals with agriculture, funds the agricultural department, justice, funds the justice department, defense, funds the defense department, right? And then they vote on those throughout the year. And then by October 1st, it's all done. Oh, because we're Congress, the Constitution gives us the power of the purse. We have decided these are our priorities. The president signs into law, and then it's the president's job as the executive to carry that out by hiring who this person wants and essentially carrying that. We can get a discussion about the executive and its authority, what Trump's arguing, anytime you want. And that's definitely your expertise, especially. So, okay. Congress for a decade or more now cannot get the government funded in time. So what they do is they just funded at last year's fiscal levels for a couple months. And then they say, all right, well, that gives us a little bit of breathing room to negotiate. That comes up, they can't agree. That comes up, they can't agree. That deadline comes up. And now here we are in March, and they can't agree on what to do. And that's every time they can't agree and they just fund it from last year's levels is called a continuing resolution or ECR. I've talked to some experts who say they feel like Congress is abdicating its most basic job and Trump is taking advantage of that, right? By just saying, well, I'm going to decide what money gets spent and I can do this through Article 2 of the Constitution.
I would offer, I don't think so, in the sense that the spending clause does give Congress the power. But this is a theme, Amber, that you and I have talked about, which is Congress ceding authority. And
yeah.
This seems like one of the biggest examples of that, where this really is a big part of what Congress does, which is come to some sort of conclusion about what our budget will look like. And then it's the president who decides whether or not to sign off. And the president takes care to faithfully execute the laws, but can't say we're not spending that money, at least under our current understanding of the Impoundment Act and in Article 2, frankly.
Right, right.
So this does feel like it's part of this creep of Congress ceding authority. And I think maybe that brings us to a bigger question that I wanted to talk about, only because I know time is limited, which is we talked about DOGE, we talked about the budget process, but I'd like to know what else you're particularly focused on in terms of these first few months of the Trump administration and maybe focusing on executive actions, because I think it's an entirely separate episode to think about what's happening with respect to foreign relations. But
yeah,
what are the other things that are on your horizon, either that have already happened and that you're following, like executive actions unrelated to DOGE, or potential future actions, like we hear reporting of the administration wanting to cut the Department of Education, but then, you know, the administration can't do that without Congress, and the administration says no. There is also, of course, these actions and lawsuits related to those actions about the federal government saying we won't provide funding to contractors or people who receive grants, who have DEI programs. So only because there's so much to choose from, what's on your current list of these are the things that I need to talk about in the next week or month?
Yeah, I would say one thing I want to talk more about, and I'm surprised the president is immigration.
Mm-hmm.
One reason I think we haven't heard much about, like relatively, about these mass deportations is because there likely aren't enough federal agents to carry those out right now, experts tell me. And so it's also really dangerous to go door to door and try to arrest people. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, has done that on a couple, taken journalists along on a couple of raids, but it's just, it hasn't ramped up the way President Trump wants to. And eventually, exhausted ICE agents are going to arrest someone and send them home that's very politically sympathetic, experts tell me. And that's what happened the last time there was like attempts at mass deportations. And I think that would be really interesting for how President Trump navigates that. And then the other question on there is with him, as always, these massive constitutional questions. Like some experts tell me, they read his executive orders about this from day one and think he's laying the groundwork to get the military involved.
Right.
Which is arguably illegal and unconstitutional, as you know, but the word invasion is used in four or five executive orders. And I think part of the idea is to tell courts, well, all these executive orders say there's an invasion, so there must be an invasion. And so under this 1790s law, I can arrest any foreign-born person with the military. That's an incredible constitutional question. I will hush now because I hear you wanting to chime in because you're the expert on this.
No, it's a constitutional question, but it's also a statutory question. I mean, you mentioned laws from the late 1700s. And so there's the Posse Comitatus Act. There's other statutes. I mean, our basic understanding is that you cannot use the military to act as a domestic police force. And then there's a but in the sense of if there is an invasion, then other laws kick into place, and I'm being specifically broad here, but I think you're right that using the word invasion in executive orders and actions dealing with immigration is not a coincidence. I think it is a strategy to be able to go to a judge. And there's been a version of this attempt in Texas, as you know, to say we have to be able to use the military. Not because we need the resources, but because legally we can do so because we are experiencing an invasion. And essentially, if you're at war with a neighboring country, and again, I'm being very broad and not quoting from the statute, then there's the possibility of using the military in situations where you otherwise couldn't. Our current understanding is that the military can serve as a backup to federal law enforcement agents who are, for instance, ICE agents, and they can provide kind of some strategic support.
Right.
But they can't be the ones actually doing the arrests. And as you point out, experts have said that, you know, the resources simply aren't there for the types of mass deportations that the president has talked about. And now it sounds like you were about to say something.
No, I was just agreeing with that. I think that's super smart. So I know there's one executive order where on day one or two, he said, oh, sending troops to the border. Like you said, they can only help out in a assistance. They can't arrest people crossing the border.
That's right. And they haven't yet. And they did assist during the Biden administration as well. So
Yeah.
So immigration absolutely is something that I am also surprised that didn't play a larger role in the joint session address. In terms of economics, maybe I could tell you where I have this very vague sense of where you are, and you can tell me what you are looking for and what you want readers and listeners to be thinking about, which is my sense is that we're one toe in, one toe out on the tariffs. And I think it's hard to follow, frankly, exactly where we are on any given day. And that's not meant as a criticism so much as a comment that tariffs were a big part of Trump's campaign. He absolutely talked about them in that joint session address. And if you could tell us, you know, on March 7th, where are we? Again, I feel like this is my question for you for the last half hour. Where are we? But where are we in terms of the tariffs? We're looking at Canada, Mexico, China. And what are economists telling you in terms of at least short-term consequences?
Yeah, it's a smart question. I wrote about this yesterday in my newsletter, 5-Minute Fix, and I was just summing it up today, too, because it changes by the day. Where are we? So this week, Trump allowed some tariffs he said he'd do on the campaign trail on the U.S. biggest trading partners, Canada, Mexico, China, to go into effect. Then he delayed a good chunk of them for a month. So will they go into effect in April? If they do, everything from clothes, tequila, natural gas would get more expensive. I think people generally understand the concept right now of tariffs because they're fairly simple, right? A tax on anything crossing the border. Trump says, hey, well, this will bring back manufacturing. It'll slow the flow of fentanyl. I haven't talked to experts about the fentanyl issue from Mexico, Canada. It's not even an issue. Disingenuous to say as much as he does. But economists say, like, tariffs will lead to inflation and potentially job losses, the feared stagflation. Like, President Biden, after the pandemic, under his watch, there was inflation, but the jobs were growing. And the jobs are growing today, as we saw. And economists also argue that, like, all this confusion is debilitating to businesses who might just hold back on spending, whether they're tariffs or not, because they just don't know what's going to happen or hold back on hiring. And so I think that's where some economic damage may have already been done just by the threat of these tariffs. And then, yeah, I wonder what political damage, if any, is done.
Well, I mean, that's right. We know that people, businesses, the markets all tend to try and react to what they think is about to happen. And so buying practices and patterns and, again, people's economic behavior can be affected by either what they think is likely to happen or based on just not being sure about what will happen. But you're right in the sense that people understand tariffs, which is a fairly basic concept, and they understand, I think, trade war in the sense of we'll raise tariffs on certain goods and then foreign countries will raise tariffs. And ultimately, the price is generally passed on to the consumer. And I think President Trump was largely elected, not only, but I think a big part of it was the economy. And I'm wondering if this is going to be a strange question, but come the midterms, do we think that our typical questions will still be the questions that we're asking? Meaning, you know, what is the price of gas? What is the price of eggs? How do people feel that the president is doing with respect to immigration? Or do you feel like things are shifting in ways that just don't look like another administration? And maybe we shouldn't use the old handbook to think about, you know, what's going to happen next. I mean, the old handbook being Republicans are in control now, things will swing back, Democrats will gain power in the House and the Senate, and particularly if the economy isn't doing well, then there'll be big gains and not much will get done in the second half of the Trump administration. I'm, for myself, just trying to think through, is that an old book that might not hold true after the next 2 years?
Well, I would say it depends on two things. Right now, strategists I talk to on both sides of the aisle say they think the old handbook you just described is still valid, still in play, that Republicans have about, I don't know, a year or so, and then Trump becomes a lame duck president. Republicans trying to get elected start looking to somewhere else for their future, which is hard to imagine, right, after a decade of Trump co-opting and dominating the party. And then the traditional battle between Republicans and Democrats began, and Democrats do have a good chance to take back the House next year. Where I think things open up is like rule of law. How much does that get eroded? And American security, how much are they concerned about that? Because isn't that like top of mind even more so than the price of eggs when it needs to be?
Yes, when it needs to be. Now, we've talked about this a little bit offline, and I think I want to end with this question because we've now gone way over what, at whatever period of time you were asked for, we're well beyond it, which is, what are you seeing with respect to the rule of law. And you and I have talked about on the record what a constitutional crisis would look like. My comment to you is, I don't think that we're there. And I know I might be in a minority because the Trump administration is still appealing orders. So
right.
Once you stop saying, I'd like you to reconsider, as long as you're saying, I'd like you to reconsider, you are respecting the system. Once you say, I don't care what you said, I'm going to do my own thing, then we have a problem. But what are you seeing just over the last kind of almost 50 days of the administration? And what are some of the things being telegraphed to us in terms of the rule of law generally, but maybe even more specifically following judges' orders?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. You're the one watching this. So I'm nervous to share my opinion because I learned from you. But we do see a couple smattering of judges, right, saying that they're worried the president isn't listening. And you've described it as like a warning. We're both parents and you tell the child, hey, come on, get your shoes on, time to go out the door. If I have to tell you again, framed it a little bit like that. And so am I wrong, Jessica, in watching how the administration responds to the Supreme Court's directive this week that a lower court can decide Trump, the administration needs to start funding these foreign aid payments to work already done to organizations abroad?
I don't think you're wrong. So we're talking about a Supreme Court order that was based on the Trump administration going to the Supreme Court and requesting emergency relief. And it was based on a lawsuit. I'm going to try and simplify this. It's based on one of the lawsuits related to stopping spending from USAID. And what the portion of the district court, meaning the trial court judge's order that was appealed, was not actually the part of the temporary restraining order that the judge issued saying, you cannot freeze this funding. It was a second part of the TRO that said, you have to pay out the contracts and grants that have already been completed and that were agreed upon during the Biden administration. And the Trump administration appealed just based on that narrow order of you must pay on those contracts and grants where the work has been completed, and said, kind of ran to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, which is obviously as close as it gets, said, we're going to let this play out in the lower court. And the lower court's going to have a hearing next on a preliminary injunction. All of which is to say, in my mind, what we're waiting for more concretely is a Supreme Court decision that says, you cannot do this by executive order. And the Trump administration then says, yes, we can, and we will ignore the Supreme Court order. That's what I'm looking at in terms of a constitutional crisis. And I know this is going to sound to people like parsing, but the Supreme Court basically said, in my view, we're not parachuting in, we're not going to jump into this case, and we're going to let it play out in the trial court. And if you want to come back, not on an emergency basis, and ask us the bigger questions, then you're free to do so. Obviously, I'm hugely paraphrasing here, and I'm giving my take on it. But this isn't the kind of decision on the merits about presidential power that I'm really on tenterhooks about.
And so it's too early. There might be like tea leaves to read, and people read them however they want. And maybe they're wrong, maybe they're right, right? It's just too early is what I hear you say.
I think that is what I'm saying. And now, obviously, other people and people point to the TikTok ban, which is not being enforced. And they say we're already in a constitutional crisis. And I frankly think that this is just a broader question of maybe different people having different definitions of what a constitutional crisis is. But for me, it's one branch actively ignoring, for instance, another. Like in this case, Congress is kind of going along. And you could say that in and of itself looks like a constitutional crisis. But the administration showing us what we all know, but maybe don't think about, which is the Supreme Court has no ability to enforce its orders and its decisions. And it's a trust exercise.
Right, right.
So now that I have pontificated on that, Amber, it's always so good to talk to you. As I said in the intro, you're the author of the 5-Minute Fix newsletter. You explain and analyze politics for the Washington Post, and your analysis is so important and key, and is the 5-Minute Fix is one of the few things that I make an effort never to miss. So thank you so much for coming back, and thank you for talking to us.
Well, thank you for having me. If it's good, it's because I called you and said, I don't understand what's going on with the rule of law and legal stuff. Help me, Jessica. So thank you.
Thank you.